That lines the U.S. Embassy in the United Arab Emirates advises American citizens there to maintain a high level of security awareness following retaliatory attacks by the Yemenis. Russia accuses the U.S. and its NATO allies of escalating tensions after the military alliance said it is boosting forces in Eastern Europe amid standoff over Ukraine. And Iran says it has regained its U.N. voting rights that were prevented as a result of non-payment of its contribution caused by U.S. sanctions. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. The Yemeni army says it has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the two allies waging a war on the country since 2015. It says vital and sensitive targets were accurately struck with drones and missiles.
They targeted the Safra airport. They also hit the Abu Dhabi airport with a big number of ballistic missiles, Zulfiqar. They targeted facilities in the area of Dubai with a big number of drones and unmanned planes of Samad 3. Also, several military posts in the heart of the Saudi area, in the area of Shobra, and other Saudi towns with bigger numbers of Samad 1 unmanned planes and also artillery fire. They hit very sensitive areas in Jazan and Asir, also with a big number of ballistic missiles.
Sari said the Yemeni army would continue its retaliatory attacks and respond to escalation with escalation. He also warned foreign firms and investors to leave the UAE as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. Saudi Arabia and the UAE have both confirmed the retaliatory strikes, but said they intercepted the ballistic missiles. The attacks come just a week after Yemeni forces struck several targets inside the Emirati soil using drones and ballistic missiles. The strikes are part of the reprisal attacks over the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and plunged the country into the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The U.S. Embassy and its consular mission in the United Arab Emirates have advised Americans there to, quote, maintain a high level of security awareness. The embassy's website posted the statement following retaliatory Yemeni attacks on the UAE capital, Abu Dhabi, and its commercial hub, Dubai, earlier today. The statement urges U.S. citizens to take appropriate steps to bolster their personal security. The American embassy issued a similar alert last week when the UAE was targeted by Yemeni missiles and drones. The strikes are part of the reprisal attacks over the Saudi-led war on Yemen, in which the UAE is an active partner. Activist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti says the UAE has been playing a destructive role in Yemen, but should now think twice before continuing those actions.
The role of the United Arab Emirates in Yemen has been so bad and so damaging and so destructive against Yemeni civilians. They are trying to separate Yemen. They are using Al-Qaeda and ISIS to fight with their troops against Yemeni army. Most of the crimes and the big attack that has happened against Yemen is conducted by United Arab Emirates fighter jet. And it was clear now the effect of the attack today against United Arab Emirates, that most of the stocks and in United Arab Emirates has fallen, and we have seen that some flight companies has cancelled their flight to Dubai and to Abu Dhabi during the attack, and this is exact proof that those missiles has reached their target. I mean, of course, maybe they gonna shoot one or two ballistic missiles, but as Mr. Sari, the spokesperson, have said, a large number of ballistic missiles has targeted Abu Dhabi, and a large number of drones has targeted as well Dubai. And this latest attack shows that Yemeni army is well equipped to launch many attacks, either north of Yemen against Saudi Arabia, like they did today, with a large number of ballistic missiles and drones against military site and sensitive site in Sharoura, in Najran, in Asir, in Jizan, and as well in Dubai and in Abu Dhabi. And the war in Yemen has actually strengthened the Yemeni army. They has Yemeni army start to develop and to make new type of weapons, new drones, and there are still some ballistic missile and some drones that have not used yet. They have been tested and they are equipped with a larger warhead. And I think that United Arab Emirates, they should be really careful to target Yemen from now on.
The standoff between the West and Russia over Ukraine is spiraling into unpleasant scenarios. Moscow is accusing the U.S. and its NATO allies of stirring up the situation through, quote, information hysteria. The Kremlin also warns of the high risk of offensive by Ukrainian troops against pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine. That after NATO said it was putting forces on standby and reinforcing deployments to eastern Europe. The Western Military Alliance also said it would continue to take all necessary measures to protect and defend all allies. Some members of the bloc have already sent ships and warplanes to the area. The West claims Russia is preparing to attack on Ukraine, which Moscow denies. The European Union now says it is drawing up a multi-billion dollar aid package for Ukraine.
First of all, the Commission proposes a new emergency macrofinancial assistance package of 1.2 billion euros. This package will help Ukraine now to address its financing needs due to the conflict.
Von der Leyen added that the 27-nation bloc stands by Ukraine. Meanwhile, U.S. media reports suggest Washington also weighs deploying thousands of troops, as well as warships and aircraft to NATO allies in Eastern Europe and Baltics. However, a Russian lawmaker has warned Moscow would respond appropriately if the U.S. deployed more troops along its border. The U.S. has already delivered two shipments of its military aid to Ukraine as part of a $200 million package it approved in December. Washington and London also are withdrawing some embassy staff and their families from Kiev. The EU, however, says it will not follow suit. Moving on, Iran's UN Ambassador Majid Takhtravanchi said that the country has regained its voting rights at the world body after fully paying its dues that the country was unable to pay due to U.S. sanctions.
We have already paid our dues, contributions to the United Nations. This has been going on for some time now. Unfortunately, the U.S. Illegal sanctions against Iran have prevented us from paying our contributions on time. But we have been working on this issue for some time now with the UN Secretariat, with the South Korean government. And finally, we have made it, and we have succeeded in sending the money to New York from Seoul. It took some time, but it happened the other day. Now the money has already been transferred to New York, and the paperwork are being done now. And the letter that is needed to be sent to the General Assembly will be issued shortly. Iran, as an active member of the United Nations, is cognizant of the fact that it has responsibility, it has rights, and we are attentive to our rights and responsibilities. And we have always paid our contributions to the United Nations on time. Unfortunately, during the last 2 years, that has not been possible because, as I said, due to the U.S. sanctions, we could not do it on time. Have been capable of paying our contributions to the UN financially, but the sanctions prevented us from doing so. Last year, it took some months to pay. This year, it's been rather, it has taken a few weeks, but finally, we were successful in arranging the necessary things, and we made it.
Meanwhile, Iran says it has never accepted any preconditions for talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has not accepted any preconditions since day one and will ignore these matters being brought up as if they are for internal and press matters. Otherwise, Iran's definitive message has been that the negotiations are complex as is, and we should not exacerbate these true complex statements.
The foreign ministry spokesman says Tehran is seeking an agreement that is sustainable and reliable with full guarantees. Hatibzadeh made the comments in reaction to the latest remarks made by U.S. Special Envoy on Iran, Robert Malley. On Sunday, Malley said the U.S. was unlikely to strike an agreement with Iran to save the JCPOA unless Tehran releases four American citizens that Washington claims are being held hostage. Hatibzadeh downplayed his remarks as being made for domestic use, saying that the American prisoners in Iran are facing clear convictions. Moving on, Iran says a recent letter by dozens of U.S. Democratic lawmakers to President Joe Biden shows Washington's so-called war on terror brought nothing but civilian toll. The Secretary of Iran's High Council of Human Rights cited the letter, saying that the U.S. conducted 14,000 drone strikes in seven countries since 2001. Kazem Gharibabadi said those strikes resulted only in the death of about 48,000 civilians and the destruction of their homes. The U.S. lawmakers cited the figures from a report by an anti-war group. They expressed grave concerns about Washington's counterterrorism policy and demanded a review. Now the UK High Court allows WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to appeal a decision to extradite him to the United States over espionage charges. The decision is the latest in Assange's long battle to avoid trial in the U.S. He can now file a plea to the UK Supreme Court against the lower court ruling on his extradition. Meanwhile, his fans gathered outside the Royal Courts of Justice in central London and welcomed the decision. American authorities are seeking the 50-year-old Australian over the publication of classified documents related to U.S.-led wars on Iraq and Afghanistan. If extradited to the U.S., he could face up to 175 years in jail. Assange was arrested after the Ecuadorian embassy in London revoked his political asylum in 2019. He was holed up there for 7 years. Now, moving on, the French military base in northern Mali has come under a mortar attack. Military sources have attributed Saturday's attack to suspected militants. At least one French soldier has been killed in these attacks. France is reorganizing its military presence in Mali after nearly 9 years of presence in the Sahel region. Under this plan, Paris would almost halve the number of its personnel in the Sahel from 5,000 currently by next year. Relations between the two countries have been strained since 2020 and the coup that happened back then in Mali. Local officials want French troops to leave the country. There have also been public protests demanding the withdrawal of the French military. For more on that, we're joined by Etunde Usazwa, from the Africa team member, actually, from the Black Alliance for Peace, who is joining us live right now. Now, thank you very much. I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name, but if you could please tell us more, shed more lights on the different aspects of France's presence in Mali and everything that's been happening so far.
Yes. So France has been committed to, you know, preserving its domination of its former colonial empire. And so they use the perception that so-called terrorist groups threaten the stability of corporations and their operations, the operations of those corporations, as a pretext to intervene. And the military forces are often deployed to protect those operations. So that military base is an important installation to serve those ends. Protect the interests of those corporations, whether or not the African people or you know, states like it. So I think, you know, it's important to understand that threat of terrorist, you know, terrorist attacks is actually often worked worsened by the presence of French forces and, you know, United Nations forces. And so, you know, references to Al-Qaeda or ISIL kind of, you know, serve to protect the interests of France, while, you know, even exploiting age-old tensions among various ethnic communities and tapping into deep-seated local grievances. So, like you mentioned, right, like many Malians believe that the Western presence doesn't really have any purpose other than protecting, you know, the exploitation of raw materials. And French policy in Mali is decried because, you know, it's considered neocolonialist by, you know, many observers and even some authorities, some politicians, local officials. So I think, you know, what we see now is that, you know, the French are looking to bring troops out. And what we've seen in the past is that, you know, when African governments decide to negotiate truces and begin dialogue with militant forces that, you know, are deemed terrorists, what we see is that, you know, when those truces are in effect, there's a dramatic decrease in the number of deaths. You know, in one region, in West Africa, you know, civilian deaths decreased from 65 in the first quarter of 2020 to 26.
Thank you very much. Mr. Assouza, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, live from Atlanta, from the Africa team member, actually, from the Black Alliance for Peace. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This is my flask. Some dates. Mm-hmm. A warm jacket. It might be colder. And this is my woolen hat. You know, I'm a type of person who is sensitive to cold. Now, let me zip up the backpack. Mm-hmm. Done. Well, you might be curious to know where I'm going to visit today, yeah? Actually, it's not a far-off place. Today, I'm going to visit a part of the beautiful nature of Tehran. Yes, Sorkhe Hesar Park. I promise it would be a brief but enjoyable visit. Stay with me. Sorkhe Hesar is one of the national parks of Iran, which is located east of Tehran, with an area of about 9,168 hectares. Except its northeastern part, all parts of this district is under the protection of the Environment Organization. The National Park of Sorkhe Hesar is one of the oldest protected zones of the world and dates back to the Qajarid era. In the past, Sorkhe Hesar used to be one of the oldest hunting areas of Iran and enjoyed a special status. It was during the rule of Agha Muhammad Khan Qajar that Jajrud region was chosen as a hunting place, and during the rule of Fath Ali Shah Qajar, the entire regions of Jajrud and Sorkhe Hesar were recognized as hunting places. This park was registered as a national park in 1980. The weather in Sorkhe Hesar is half dry, and the difference of temperature between day and night is high. Jajrud River flows in this region, and after passing through the Latian Dam, flows in the marginal parts of the region, and then spills into Parchin Township and leaves off. This park is created from meadows, hills, and heights, which are as high as 1,220 to 2,147 meters. I am now at Sorkhe Hesar Park. What a clean air! In front of me, just far away from me, those hills are blanketed with snow. However, in this part which I'm standing, there is no snow, but it's so cold. I'd better wear my gloves. Sorkhe Hesar Park has diverse flora. There are different types of trees, bushes, shrubs, and herbs in this park. Some of these herbs have medicinal effects, and there are also rare types of herbs in this region, which are unfortunately on the verge of becoming extinct. Tell you an interesting fact. Sorkhe Hesar has two types of flora. One type, which has plants of hot regions, including tamarisk, milkweed, and wild rue. And the other type, which has steppe-like plants, including thymes, zizifora, and pennyroyal. Though, there is no trace of these herbs here because of the cold. If it wasn't a cold season, I would pick some zizifora for my grandma. She loves it in her tea. Oh, the sound of these birds is very beautiful. I can recognize some of these sounds. Though, there are many types of birds here. There is heron, hawk, bitterns, even vulture in here. Sorkhe Hesar has also a diverse fauna and is indeed the treasury of Iran's environment. Thank you. well, Sorkha Hisar, besides its great nature, has many facilities to entertain you. Here, there is a cycling route. Good job! And also, there is a road for those who like to hike in the nature. On my right, there is a sports complex which has facilities for sports like tennis, paintball, billiards, darts, and shooting. And here, there is also a theme park for children. In this park, children can have fun and at the same time, get educated about the culture of traffic. And there is a pergola here, which sells tea and coffee. Drinking a cup of Iranian tea in this weather really hits the spot. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
If we want to know what direction we need to have in life, having a text that tells us how it's done is not enough. You need a coach. We need a coach. We need someone. While we look at that text, the Holy Quran, the most profound, accurate, and deep text that can ever be created, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put all those teachings in the Holy Quran. Text, however, is not enough. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala never sent a book in writing and left it without a person or a people to be coaches for others to learn through that text where to go and how to maneuver and how to move forward. The coach that we are in need of, that while we look at that text, we look at the Quran, we're supposed to, without that also we cannot understand, we cannot move forward with that coach. Part of the sayings and the teachings of those coaches, the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, Salamullah alayhim ajma'in, is the necessity of reading the Quran as well. We have to look at that. However, it is not sufficient for us to simply and only read them. And I'm not referring to looking at hadith. When I say going to the coaches besides the text, I'm not referring to going to the words of the ma'sumin recorded in books of hadith, although that's also necessary. That is necessary. That is a need that we have. We do need to go to the words of the Ahlul Bayt as well. Whatever has been documented, and there's an abundance of words, teachings, guidances, explanations, further explanations of the verses of the Holy Quran, in case we get confused, and we do get confused in regards to what those verses are telling us. Besides that, what we're saying is that there is a need for a coach. A coach is not another text. The words of the Ahlul Bayt that have been recorded in books have turned into text for us. And that's another set of words and statements that we're reading in a book or in books. Again, the discussion was that texts, words are not sufficient. You need a coach. A coach is someone that doesn't just limit their instructions to general guidances, general words, let's say a brochure or a booklet that they hand to their students, their pupils, the trainees. That's not what a coach does. That's not what a trainer does. A trainer has to be with the trainee, spend time with the trainee, and tell the trainee, this is exactly where you need to do this and you need to do that. Rather than simply giving a booklet, yes, the booklet is there. The person needs to read on their own. But then when they go for the training, the coach is watching them, observing them. The person who read that text understood it, but didn't realize this is the application of this particular teaching here, because they don't have experience with it. So now the coach tells them, well, this is what that meant. This is where you need to do this. That's where you need to do that. You get familiar with what you need to do through the text, but you make mistakes in applying it. You don't know that your state of mind, your state of heart, your state of society, your state of politics, and so on and so forth, is the particular condition you're in. You don't realize it, although the teachings are there. But because we don't have experience, that's why we're being trained. That's why we're trainees. We don't have that experience. Someone who does, who knows exactly where and when, what's going to be beneficial, in what condition, is able to identify those conditions, the applications of the rules of the laws. They need to be with us and tell us, this is what you need to do and that's what you need to do. Don't do this, do that, and so on and so forth. We're in need of a coach, a real coach. We get lost sometimes when we're talking about the Imam of our time. We're talking about tyranny, we're talking about tyrannical regimes, we're talking about capitalism and all of that. How do we present a model that will bring true and real prosperity to everyone? Both what is that intellectually, conceptually, and more importantly, how do we move in that direction? Even if you read the Quran and the verses of the Quran, the words of the Ahlul Bayt, the words of Ali ibn Abi Talib, Nahjul Balagha, outside of Nahjul Balagha, all these great words, this is what an Islamic government needs to be like, this is how an Islamic society needs to be like, this is how the globe needs to be governed. All those are great, but how do you get there? What are the steps? We need coaching. We need to receive that guidance from the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in. They know who else has the knowledge. Who else has a type of knowledge that doesn't need experience, because they know it all. Not only do they know it conceptually, they know what is going to happen. The book of Fatima to Zahra, Mus'hafu Fatima, that was carried and is carried by the Ahlul Bayt, by the Imam of our time, Mus'hafu Fatima, Salamullahi Alayha, which is written, the handwriting is the handwriting of Ali ibn Abi Talib, but it was dictated by Fatima to Zahra. She received this to write, otherwise she already had it, but she was told to write, to have this written, and Ali ibn Abi Talib wrote it down. Mus'hafu Fatima. This contains everything that will happen until the day of judgment. What does that even mean, a book containing all of that? Whatever it means, it says that that's what it contains, and that's only the written version of it. It's the written version. That's the script of it. What's in them, what's in their hearts, what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has showed them, has shown them, is something that we just can't understand. They know exactly, and they know exactly what God wants the believers to do. every step of the way, particularly to the minute, to the second. Should we not refer to them? Should we just work on our own and think that our brains, our minds, our experiences can tell us what to do and what not to do? We are told to try our best. But there's a difference between a person who says, I'm trying my best because God told me to. I'm using my mind because God told me to. I'm using my heart because God told me to. But God also told me that this is all deficient. You need to refer to me. And how you're going to refer to me is through these lights, through these Ahlbayt. I have shown them. You want the path, go to them. You want to know, go to them. You want progress, go to them. You want prosperity in this life for yourself, go to them. You want to move society towards prosperity, you look at the conditions of the people of the world, you get sick of it, you don't know what to do, you're saddened by all the atrocities globally. Try your best, it's your taklif, but know that you're not enough, you're not efficient, you have deficiencies. You need to connect to the Ahlul Bayt. If you make that connection, they will. I have shown them, and they will show you what to do, and you will move in that direction.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Some Trumpland observers are convinced that he is in serious legal trouble as New York Attorney General investigation of Trump Organization's finances intensifies. We are prepared for you an article written by Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled House of Trump is Crumbling, Why Ex-President's Legal Net is Tightening. when former U.S. President Donald Trump announced plans in 2006 to build a golf complex on ancient sand dunes on the Aberdeenshire coast in Scotland, he told reporters it was love at first sight. He said, "As soon as I saw it, there was no question about it. It would be the world's greatest golf course." Recently, Trump International Scotland became a central element of a case that looks poised to dominate his post-presidential life and could even put him behind bars. Local fishermen denounced Trump as a loudmouth bully during construction of the course. Environmentalists warned the development would destroy the natural habitat, and sure enough, it did inflict such damage that the site was stripped of its protected status. But none of this deflected Trump from his goal. Today, the Scottish complex stands as a premier luxury golf course experience replete with five-star hotel and helicopter landing pad at a bargain membership price of £2,595 a year. 15 years on, the property has done wonders for its owner. That is, if you measure success according to the idiosyncratic accounting style of Donald Trump. He bought the 2,000-acre site at Menny in 2006 for $12.6 million. Within 5 short years, it was valued by the Trump Organization in its financial statements at $161 million, an increase of almost 13 times. By 2014, the windswept Scottish holding was put at $436 million. The hike caught the attention of Letitia James, New York State's progressive attorney general, known for her relentless pursuit of the rich and the powerful. How the Scottish property came to rise meteorically in value is one of the matters she is exploring in her continuing investigation into Trump Organization finances. In a new filing released recently designed to pressure Trump and two of his children, Ivanka and Donald Jr., into facing questions, Letitia James forensically dissects how such strikingly large valuations came about. Her investigators discovered the 2011 estimate for the Scottish property included an estimated £75,000 or $120,000 at 2011 exchange rates for undeveloped land at the site. Investigating deeper, they found that the figure had been created for an article in Forbes magazine. The revelation prompted a line in recent filing that must be among the tartest in U.S. financial history. Letitia James writes, "It thus appears that the valuation of Trump Aberdeen, used for Mr. Trump's financial statement, was prepared for purposes of providing information to Forbes magazine in a quote." Letitia James's legal document is packed with similarly juicy tidbits. The 2014 value of the Scottish Golf Club was based in part on the projected sale price of 2,500 houses on the land, even though none of the houses actually existed and the company had planning permission for only half that number. In 1995, the Trump Organization bought a parcel of land in Westchester, New York, known as the Seven Springs State, for $7.5 million. By 2004, it was valued at $80 million, and by 2014, at $291 million. Letitia James notes in another exquisitely tart reference that 2014 figure included the valuation of $161 million for 7 non-existent mansions. The juiciest tidbits of all concerns Trump's former home, the gilded Fifth Avenue temple of his own ego dubbed Versailles in the Sky, in which he lived before moving into the White House. Letitia James's investigators were puzzled to find a Trump Tower triplex in Manhattan was listed at $327 million in 2015, based on the apartment's size, allegedly 30,000 square feet. In fact, the property is only 11,000 square feet, which produces a value of $117 million. That's an overstatement in Trump's official finance statements of more than $200 million. Letitia James insists in her 114-page filing such startling disparities matter. The financial statements that contained them were used to secure loans from banks as well as insurance, and in other instances to reduce Donald Trump's tax burden. Letitia James said that after the filing was lodged in a New York court, "We have uncovered significant evidence that suggests Donald J. Trump and the Trump Organization falsely and fraudulently valued multiple assets and misrepresented those values to financial institutions for economic benefit." The new material disclosed by James was so compelling that some close observers of Trump land are now convinced that he is in serious legal trouble. Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former personal attorney and an ex-vice president of the Trump Organization, told The Guardian, "The House of Trump is crumbling." Michael Cohen, who was released in November from house arrest, having had his own legal difficulties, has skin in this game. It was his testimony to the House Oversight Committee in February of 2019 that sounded the alarm bells over allegedly inflated evaluations in Trump's financial statements, which in turn prompted the Attorney General, Letitia James, to open her investigation the following month. Michael Cohen said, "My testimony before the committee, as well as my subsequent cooperation with the New York Attorney General, has led to this day. We are seeing individuals who have continuously escaped responsibility for their actions finally being held accountable." Letitia James is pursuing her investigation as a civil case, which means that were Trump to be found liable, it could cost him heavily in fines and penalties. More seriously, James is working in coordination with the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, a similarly tenacious and relentless prosecutor equipped with a large and highly experienced team of investigators. But the times have changed. Donald Trump is no longer a real estate magnate turned reality TV star. He is a former U.S. president. The stakes have increased significantly, and with them the scrutiny. Never before has Trump been confronted by two coordinated teams of sophisticated investigators, raking through his financial affairs, with both civil and criminal charges possibly pending. Just how serious the prosecutors are about nailing their man is revealed in a single sentence of Letitia James's new filing. She writes that the investigative team is determined to find out Mr. Trump's actual knowledge of and intention to make the numerous misstatements and omissions made by him or on his behalf. Intention to make indicates that Letitia James is not only thinking along civil lines, she's also anticipating possible criminal charges in which proof of the intent of the accused is required. Donald Trump continues to resist giving testimony, as do two of his children, on grounds that the investigations are politically motivated witch hunts. Both James and Bragg are Democrats. A third child, Eric Trump, who runs the day-to-day work of the Trump Organization, was deposed but pleaded the fifth more than 500 times. Prosecutors will have to prove that Trump knowingly and willfully violated the law. That can be tough. Showing discrepancies in financial statements, juicy though they may be, is not enough. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from Leather's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
I wish to stress that the event of January 9th in Qom and also the following events are an indication of the depth of religious belief in the people. The event took place as a result of the role played by a religious authority, who was a source of a religious knowledge. In other words, if our late Imam, may God bestow paradise on him, had not played a pivotal role as a religious authority, religious leader and revolutionary scholar, that event and other such events would not have taken place. No other person and no other movement would have been able to drive a city, then another city, followed by many other cities, and ultimately an entire nation, to such an undertaking. You know that during the time of the tyrannical rule of the Pahlavis, hundreds of great personalities from different political orientations, some or many of whom were revolutionary people from leftist, rightist, Marxist, and other orientations, were threatened, imprisoned, tortured, hanged, and insulted. But these people's moves did not bring about any changes. They were unable to influence the social life of the people in any way. But when they wrote a few lines against our magnanimous imam in a newspaper, it led to the great event in Qom.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This means that the event of January 9th is greatly linked to religious authorities, religious scholars, religion, and religious matters. And I tell you that most of the important events that have taken place over the past 150 years in our country are like this. As far as I remember, in almost all historical and social events during which the people entered the arena and were able to achieve a certain result, a religious source was involved. One who was brave and knew about political developments. For example, concerning the issue of tobacco, the leader was Mirza Shirazi. Regarding the constitutional movement, the leaders were the religious authorities in Najaf and the great scholars in Tehran, Tabriz, Isfahan, and other cities.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.